One of our online worshipers this morning commented that only our worship team could sound that great, even wearing masks. That was really cool to see. Transform, thank you for all of your hard work, for all of your rehearsal time. Leslie, thank you for your leadership. Very few people recognize how much rehearsal time goes into that, and also how much we are dependent on our sound and technology team to make sure that folks can hear both in person and online. Two completely different mixes of sound, two completely different things going on there. So we want to be thankful for our sound and technology team as well. Thank you all for your contributing to our worship and helping us worship God and glorify God in such a profound way. Thank you. I want to go back to 1994 as we start off this morning. 1994, there was a movie that came out that still has significant bearing on our culture. Now, it's been critiqued a little bit in the years past. It's been critiqued for how it treats the subject of people with developmental disabilities or delayed learning, those sorts of things. And it also has been critiqued a little bit for its flippant manner of dealing with historical events. But all in all, whatever you think about the movie, you have to admit that many quotes and isms, if you will, from this movie persist in our regular cultural lexicon. One of the most well-known lines from this movie comes toward the beginning, where the two companions, the star of the film and his good friend Jenny, are walking home from school. And as they're walking home, some bullies on bikes come by and they start chasing the main character, who immediately dashes off. And Jenny, his friend, screams at the top of her lungs. You remember, right? Run, Forrest, run! And that's what Forrest does. He runs. Have you ever had to run away from a dangerous situation? I mean, not just bullies on bikes, but a dangerous situation that maybe even is life-threatening. As I was writing this week, I was thinking about just a couple of weeks back, at the end of December, how the folks in Louisville and Superior, Colorado, were feeling. As they woke up one morning and they heard that the wildfires that had been in a distance were now in their rural county areas, and so there was some concern. They could see the smoke billowing up, but that was something they were concerned about for the folks in the rural counties areas of the county. Within a couple of hours, they had people pounding on their doors and calling them and contacting them saying, leave now. Get out. Run. Get in your cars. Grab what you can carry. Don't pack anything else. And get out. Because the winds had begun to gust at such a level. There were 80-mile-an-hour gusts. So much so that areas as large as a football field were being scorched in seconds. So these people ran. They ran and drove as fast as they could to get away. And that's how it works, right? At least how we'd imagine. If your life and your family's lives are in danger, life-threatening danger, you run. You do whatever you can to get your family and your neighbor safe. Now, it's this adrenaline rush of running that permeates our scripture story today. We're going to take this story in three different episodes because that's how I think it works best, all forming one narrative that takes place over a few years here. But we're going to start in Matthew 2, and we're going to start with verse 13. This is a story that's a part of the Christmas narrative that we rarely get to. It's a part that, honestly, if we're being straight with one another, this is a story we run away from. So let's read it together. After they had gone, and the they is the wise men, the magi, who we talked about last week. After they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. Get up, he said. Take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him. So Joseph got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet. Out of Egypt I called my son. Joseph is sleeping peacefully when he hears the voice of an angel. The voice is insistent and urgent. Get up now, grab Mary, grab toddler Jesus, grab enough food for the night, and run. Get out of here. Because Herod, that narcissistic, ruthless dictator of a king, is afraid that Jesus will one day take his throne, and he's coming after him, because Herod will do anything possible to protect his power and his privilege. Now, let's remember here, Joseph knows what an angel in a dream sounds like. He's not confused about this at all. He bolts upright, he wakes up Mary, he grabs Jesus, they saddle the donkey, they pack the diaper bag, they get the medication, the things they absolutely have to have, and they run. Now, this is not a trip where they made lists. This is not a trip where they held the mail, notified the neighbors, made sure the security system was set, and made sure they had left enough food out for the cat. This is a trip where they ran. What would you do? What would you do if your toddler child in your family or your grandchild was in immediate danger where you lived? You'd do the exact same thing they did. You'd run. You'd leave everything behind if you had to. But you would take them and you would run until you were safe. But where can they go to be safe? Herod controls all of Judea. Where could they go? Ironically, the angel sends the Son of God to the very nation that 1,300 years before Moses had delivered the people of Israel out of. Ironically, Egypt, which had been the place of slavery for God's people, becomes the place of safety for God's Son. God apparently does have some sense of humor and irony. Egypt doesn't seem like it would be that safe, though, because it's still under the direction of the Roman Empire, albeit in a different way than Judea is. But Herod has no power in Egypt. So Mary and Joseph and toddler Jesus, they go approximately 600 miles, probably to Alexandria, Egypt. It is known at this time that there was a large contingent of Jewish people that lived in Alexandria. So they probably ended up there, although we don't necessarily know where they went in Egypt. We just know the reason. Protect the family. By the way, we have a word for people like Mary and Joseph Jesus, people who have to flee their homeland to live in a foreign country due to fear of persecution or death, or maybe due to a natural disaster. We have a word for these people that have to flee and live in a foreign place. They're called refugees. That's right. Mary, Joseph, and Jesus were refugees. They ran for their lives because of the threats, actions, and fear for their safety at the hands of an autocratic government. Thankfully, there were people in Egypt that were there to welcome them and keep them safe. But they had to run. They had to run like their lives depended on it, because they did. Now, this episode of the running flight to Egypt brings up a number of questions in my mind, and I wrestled with a lot of those questions this week in my office, but I'll just share a couple of them with you. First question I had, actually I have three questions because I like three. First question, what are you running from? Everybody runs from something. What are you running from? Is there something in your past or your present that has you running? Maybe you're running from a past relationship, a past memory. Maybe you're running from a major decision or a commitment that you're wrestling with. Maybe you're running from something that you're afraid of. At one point or another, we all run from something. The next question that comes to mind is, where are you going? With your life, where are you going? Most of us, if we're honest, we just answer that question. We say, well, I'm just trying to get to Friday. Or whatever your weekend might be. Where are you going? Well, I'm just trying to get through. I'm just trying to get to retirement. I'm just trying to get till my kids get to college. I'm just trying to get till my kids get married. I'm just trying to get through till I graduate. Where are you going? There are a lot of people running in our culture. They're running at breakneck speed and they don't know where they're going. At some point, we stop running and we look at ourselves in the mirror and we say, what am I about? What am I doing? Where am I going with this life that I've been given? Whenever I've been running, What I've discovered is that God's direction is the only thing that's kept me safe. Where are you going? That's a big life question, isn't it? Another question that came to mind as I was looking at this episode is, how am I and how are we doing at welcoming strangers? Think about this for just one moment. Somewhere in Egypt long ago, an expat Jewish family, or maybe an Egyptian peasant family, saw a bedraggled, unkempt, rushing man, woman, and toddler. And even as they saw the fear in their eyes, they welcomed them into their home. They fed them, gave them a place to sleep. And after a few days, they helped them find their own place in this area of the world that was not theirs. Maybe they helped even Joseph find a job so he could pay for some things and they could make their own way, make their own living. And one day, a few years later, when this couple and their young son, Jesus, were going back to Israel because they felt they'd be safe there again, one day this family hugged their necks and wished them a good journey, never knowing that in their welcoming of these strangers from another land, never knowing that they had embraced the Son of God. They had housed the Son of God. What would it be like to welcome, nurture, and protect the family of Jesus? Actually, Jesus told us that what we do to others, particularly to those who are alone, forgotten, and frightened, when we do things for them, we're actually doing it for Jesus himself. Jesus made it clear that how we treat other people is how we are treating him. How we treat the stranger, the ones that are forgotten, the ones that may not, quote unquote, belong, that is in effect how we are treating Jesus. How are we doing at welcoming the stranger? How are you doing at welcoming the new neighbor across the street, welcoming the person in your office, welcoming the person in your classroom? How are you doing welcoming the person who has a different skin tone than you, speaks a different language than you, maybe votes different than you? How are you doing at welcoming the stranger? This is not a superfluous question, especially when the Savior of the world has told us that how we welcome others depicts how we are welcoming him. When we welcome the hurting, lonely stranger, we are welcoming Jesus himself. Just a few questions from that episode of the story, but now we have to move on. We have to move on to the section of the story that is deeply unnerving and deeply upsetting. We go to verse 16 where it says, "When Herod recognized he'd been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under." Did you hear that? Gave orders to kill every boy 2 years old and younger in that vicinity because he couldn't run the risk of any of them being a king who would one day threaten his throne. Think about when you're a boy, if you've ever had a son. Think about when he was two or younger. And let this hit home a minute. "Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more." Rachel there is figurative, of course. Rachel represents the whole of Israel weeping for their children. Rachel was the wife of Jacob, the mother of the people of Israel. And she weeps even for these who were executed at the word of Herod the Great. Herod the Great, a paranoid, narcissistic, ruthless leader who, in word, his reign was subject to the Roman Empire, but Rome gave Herod a great deal of latitude in how he reigned, and he used this latitude in brutal, cruel ways to protect his power. Herod's house and government was characterized by intrigue, deception, and rumors of conspiracies. There was always whispering going on in the hall. Herod executed numerous individuals for plotting against him, or even if he thought they were plotting against him. He next executed numerous individuals, including his brother-in-law, his wife. Well, actually, he ended up, through the course of his life, having 10 wives, so maybe he executed more than one. We're not quite sure. He executed his mother-in-law. Yeah, we'll just leave that there. He had 15 sons that we know of, and he executed several of them. Executed his own sons because he was concerned about them plotting against him. As a matter of fact, there was a saying that went around at the time that people said, certainly out of Herod's earshot, because of what would happen to him. The saying went like this: it was better to be Herod's pig than Herod's son. At least Herod might let the pig live. Herod attacked his enemies before they could attack him. The slightest hint of disloyalty sent him into a murderous rage. He made it his mission to be sure that no one would ever get a first step on him. As a matter of fact, there's been a lot of archaeological work done around Herod, and there's something that's recently been unearthed, kind of a motto, if you will, for how Herod lives his life. As a matter of fact, we have a picture here of what's been unearthed. I think we've got it for you. Right there, see? Right there. Strike hard. Strike first, strike hard, no mercy. It's amazing they unearthed this and it was in English. Isn't that incredible? Really incredible. No, obviously this strike first, strike hard, no mercy comes from the recent Karate Kid update on Netflix, Cobra Kai. But I have to say, I think Herod would have made an incredible Cobra Kai. Because he didn't wait on anybody to mess with him. He hit them first. He hit him hard, and he showed no mercy. He was ruthless. He felt no remorse. So think about it. If he had to execute his own son, do you think for a second he gave any concern at all for executing a bunch of 2-year-old and under boys that he didn't even know? The man was deranged and sick with a lust for power. This part of the story is awful and horrible, and there's a reason we don't seem to ever tell it. But it does bring up some important questions for us. Again, just checking my notes to make sure, I have 3 questions. Why did God allow this to happen? Right? Why did God allow this to happen? It's always that critical question whenever we come face to face with something that's evil, whether it's personal evil that we face in our own lives or it's evil that we face on a cultural or more systemic basis. Why does God let this happen? And obviously a treatment of theodicy, the idea of talking about God in relation to evil, we don't have time for all of that in the amount of time we have left together. But we do need to point out one thing. These children dying in this episode, this was Herod's decision. This was Herod's action. And it reminds us that when God creates human beings, what Genesis tells us is that God created human beings in his own image, which means that we carry with us the ability to make our own choices, the ability to use our free will, and we can use that free will for good or for evil. We have to choose. God does not manipulate us. In choosing, God invites us into his way of the kingdom. But God gives us the free rein to choose. Because that's what good shepherds do. That's what good parents do. They love, give freedom. And Herod, with his freedom, chose to bludgeon people so that he could keep what was his, no matter what the cost. And that pains God. What is God doing about things like that? Because Herod is hardly the last person in human history that has used people for his own gain, that has hurt people to prop himself up. Why doesn't God do something about all this? Friends, you know the biggest thing God has done in human history, at least since Jesus' death and resurrection, you know the biggest thing God has done to try and end systematic evil and injustice and abuse like what we see with Herod? God founded the church. The church, the people of God, the people who follow Jesus Christ, we are called as followers of Jesus to stand up against evil, injustice, and brokenness in our world. It is God's people who must stand up against the selfish and evil choices of dictators, politicians, executives, companies, neighbors, anyone. God has called us not only to live in love, but to stand up against what is unjust and unloving. Which leads me to my next question. How are you and I loving broken and vulnerable children? How are we loving broken and vulnerable children? Notice I didn't ask how you're loving your children. I'm assuming you're doing that. I didn't ask how you're making the world better for your children. I mean, that's basic parenting, right? In most cases, parents want a world that is better for their children. What I asked is, how are we loving broken and vulnerable children? In other words, how are we loving children as if they are our own children? Now, I imagine when I ask that question, many people are thinking of different things. Some are thinking about standing up for unborn children whose lives are ended out of convenience. Some are thinking about standing up for children who are separated from their parents by war, or maybe separated at a border. Still others are thinking of specific children they know who are suffering from diseases and accidents. Teachers are thinking of the children in their schools who have fallen behind because of a lack of resources, parental support, or maybe even just emotional exhaustion due to this pandemic. Perhaps others are thinking of a child they sponsor, maybe through World Vision or Compassion or another organization. The point is, there are children suffering everywhere. And as God's people, we are called to invest in the training, mentoring, and loving of children whose lives are in peril, not because of Herod, but because of loneliness, anxiety, developmental challenges, family struggles, hunger, drugs, disease, and so many other barriers, both individual and systemic barriers. Friends, we're not called to complain about the state of the children in our world. You know how that goes. Man, kids these days just don't know what they're missing. Man, kids these days have it easy. Man, kids these days don't know how to work. You know, you've heard that stuff. You've said that stuff. We're not called to do those kind of things. We're called to act with compassion on behalf of all children, not just our own. Because children sometimes don't have a choice in how they're being treated. They need folks who will advocate for them. Finally, another question. Herod makes me think about, how am I doing a developing self-control? Because as you can see, when it came to his anger, Herod had no self-control. When it came to his lust for power, he had no self-control. He would destroy anyone, not only that got in his way, or anyone he thought was getting in his way. Remember, strike hard. Strike first. Strike hard. No mercy was Herod's mantra for living. And believe me, he would strike first because he had no self-control. Ironically, Herod was successful according to a lot of metrics. He won wars. He built great buildings. He engaged in public work projects that employed lots of people. Unemployment went down during Herod's era. And yet, he killed people. because he had no self-control over his anger and his lust for power. Friends, there's nothing more deadly than people in power who have no self-control. Without self-control, people torpedo their lives with lust, anger, gossip, spending, food, neediness, laziness, greed, careless words, pride, and selfishness. That's why Paul in Galatians 5 lists self-control as one of the fruit of the Spirit. We are called to develop self-control as followers of Jesus. Self-control in every area of life, because we are not supposed to have anything control us that is not the Spirit of God. So friends, what's controlling you? Or maybe not right now. What is the thing that you battle with during the week that threatens to control you or tip you over the edge? Some people struggle to control their anger. Others could struggle to control their spending. Others struggle to control a lust for power, a lust for people, a lust for anything. Others struggle to control their greed, whatever it might be. Some people struggle to control their own superiority, their idea that they're better than other people. What is it that you struggle to control? That if you don't get self-control over it, will ruin your life? Well, at some point we have to land the plane here, so let's conclude the story. The story ends this way, starting with verse 18. After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, and he said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who are trying to take the child's life are dead." So Joseph got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. When he heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee. And he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets: "He will be called a Nazarene." A few years go by and Herod the Great dies. And Joseph again gets word from a dream that it's time for them to go back to Israel. So they pack everything up for the 600-mile journey and get moving. At least they didn't have to run this time. At least they could make some plans. Now, as they were traveling, Joseph heard that Archelaus, Herod the Great's son, was in charge in Judea. And through the voice of an angel, he determines to go back to their hometown of Nazareth rather than to Bethlehem. Now, interestingly enough, Nazareth and Galilee, which is in Galilee, are also controlled by a son of Herod, Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas, we get to see him later in the story of Jesus. Herod Antipas is responsible for the beheading of John the Baptist. He's not such a great guy either. Herod, not John the Baptist. He also ends up being the Herod that is a part of Jesus' trial when Jesus is arrested. And this is the land where they go to live, under the reign of Herod Antipas. They go there because Galilee is a place you can get lost. Galilee is a place where you can recede into the background. Galilee is a place where Mary and Joseph have some understanding of how to live. They grew up in Nazareth. So they can go back and have the benefit of family and kind of blend into the surroundings. So that's what they do. They go and become anonymous. So anonymous that for the next 28 years, we hear nothing of Jesus' life, except for one story in Luke about Jesus visiting the temple when he was 12. At this point, the story of Jesus goes silent as they recede into the background to await the time when he will begin his ministry. It's kind of interesting, though. We don't get the idea that Jesus has overcome all of his enemies. It's almost like the enemies of Jesus, the adversaries of the kingdom of God, it's almost like they go into dormancy as well. waiting for the time where they can pop out and stand against all of the kingdom of God work, just like Herod stood against Jesus. I wonder, as Mary and Joseph watch Jesus grow up across the Nazarene countryside, I wonder how often their minds went back to that night they had to flee. I wonder if their hearts ever truly settled down again from that fear. I wonder if they looked at Jesus and thought about the children whose lives were lost due to Herod's fear and rage. I wonder how they embraced the gratitude of deliverance and the burden of the suffering. That, friends, is my final question. How do you live with gratitude and suffering at the same time? I think that's a very fair question considering the state we find ourselves in now. Because we live between the polarities of gratitude and suffering. We're grateful for the deliverance we've experienced during this COVID season, and yet we carry the burden that not all of us have experienced deliverance. We carry the burden that many have lost their lives. Many have lost family members and dear friends. Many have lost jobs and businesses. Many have lost faith in our political system and our hope for the future. Many of us are simply emotionally scarred and beaten down, anxious and depressed due to this season. And yet we are grateful that we still get up in the morning. We still breathe. We still connect with the wonder of God. I'm mindful of the song we sang to start the service this morning, My Story. It's from a band called Big Daddy Weave. They have a few songs that are very meaningful to me. This song is one that I really love. I love the idea of thinking of what my story is like because of Jesus. A couple of weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago now, Jay Weaver, who's the bassist in Big Daddy Weave, passed away. He was 42 years old. He died of COVID. He had a lot of other health afflictions and conditions that made it much harder for him to fight COVID. And now, he rests with Jesus. So even in singing that song this morning, I was torn between knowing the pain that band walks with and knowing the gratitude that Jay's story, that my story, that your story is shaped by Jesus, is held in the hands of Jesus. So friends, what is your story? It is a story, if it is like mine, that rests in between gratitude and suffering, where we have to live with both of them. We have to live with that tension. Even in our deliverance, we are deeply scarred. And yet what we learn from Mary and Joseph's run is this. In the aftermath of tragedy and disruption, God keeps calling. God does not need ideal circumstances to love you. God does not need ideal circumstances to lead you or to lead us. God does not need ideal circumstances to transform you. God does not need ideal circumstances to call you back from wherever you've been. Because your story, friends, yours and mine, is that we are loved deeply by God. And that because of the power of His Son, Jesus Christ, we are invited back into friendship with Him, regardless of what's going on in our life, in our world. That is the greatest blessing. As we sing our closing song, as we worship together, I want to invite you. I want to invite you to think about your story with God, where your story is right now. I want to invite you to think about what you're running from and to consider that maybe it's time to stop running and to plant your feet in the foundation of Jesus Christ. I want to ask you, where are you going with your life? And if you can't answer that question, maybe it's time to think about a renewal of your life going forward in the direction of the kingdom of Jesus and being at work for His power and being at work to see His love run rampant in the world. Whatever's going on with you, friends, whatever circumstances you're wrestling with, they are not so hard, not so difficult that Jesus cannot guide you through them. He is the Good Shepherd. He is the one who does not need the ideal in order to create relationship. Let's stand and let's sing.